Today, let me go back a millennium and ask a similar sort of question. And this time we're looking at culture, and we're looking at cultural engagement and understanding culture and how to respond. Actually, we're going to look at how not to respond, to set the stage of how we think about this as Christians. And these are reflections from another, but I share them with you. I agree with him. On November 27th, 1095, Pope Urban II delivered the speech that launched the Crusades. Some call it the most influential speech in human history. Everyone today agrees that the Crusades were a disaster. So is there any point in revisiting them? Yes, this author writes, because of this sad fact. The case for the Crusades was so well suited to the culture that almost every major Christian leader of the age fervently endorsed them. Bernard of Clairvaux, Thomas Aquinas, Francis of Assisi, Catherine of Siena, and more. And he asks the probing question, how did this happen? He talks about some of the history. In other words, you can't understand this unless you understand what preceded this speech given by Pope Urban II. But it resonated with his hearers because at the heart of it was this notion of pilgrimage and honor and brotherhood and a host of other things. It made sense to conquer the culture back. Get it back. In the midst of those that were taking the Christian culture away. Of course, it's the spread of Islam, right? And so Urban's speech had an unprecedented effect, this author says, because it combined familiar and widely accepted themes in a fresh way for an exalted cause. Think about this. Now, obviously, we look at this and the doctrinal errors are obvious. There's penance. There's promise to this. Don't overlook the fact that there are huge political machinations involved in this. It's not just religious. And we don't even buy into even closely that we advance God's work by force. But the cultural error is one we must face. And I read now his conclusion. Europe was armed. Allegedly Christian camp in Urban's day. Instead of questioning this, Urban tried to redirect it. Urban failed. The Crusades were disastrous in every way. Untold numbers died in vain. The Christian knights acted like barbarians and fools and killed both Muslims and also fellow believers. It would be all too easy, he writes, to condemn Urban and his age, but we must ask, here's the key. Why did almost everyone agree with him when his thoughts seem so clearly false to us? The answer is that he and his contemporaries baptized notions from their culture that are alien to Scripture. Pilgrimage. The need to forcibly avenge affronts to the clan's honor. The idea that works of penance are instrumental to salvation. The challenge is clear. We need to ask ourselves, as part of what this conference is about, what cultural values do we baptize? Which of our culture's universally accepted values are actually at odds with the character, word, and will of God? I think this author's right. And I think he asks the right question. And it affirms the need for this conference. Well, we've looked at the Bible, we've looked at church history, we looked at culture, continue to look at culture. So in the midst of this culture, how then do we understand the Bible's application? How do we move from Bible to theology? And often what I find happens, which is what we've asked Fred Sanders to address, is that people either equate the Bible with my theology. Now, is that right? Is my theology sola scriptura? No. See, my theology is always reformable back to the sola scriptura, the absolute authority, which alone is what? The Word of God. So either we make a one-for-one when we feel threatened, or we simply say, it doesn't really mean anything. It can mean so many things that it means nothing. So we just, it, nice stories, and then you move towards, it's got a nice ethic of Jesus, but it doesn't have a whole lot more. So what we have asked Fred Sanders to address this morning is this. It's one thing to move from the Bible to theology. It's another thing to move from theology to life application while considering the cultural context in which one lives, so that theology is lived and applied in a contemporary, not bygone day. Answering today's questions with 50-year-old answers is not helpful. How does one do this faithfully, rooted in the scriptures and being sensitive to culture without allowing culture to dictate or mandate what one sees or reads in scriptures? This is what we've asked Fred Sanders to address this morning. As he comes, let me pray. Father, these are important days. And for some, Lord, it moves in a pessimistic direction. And for some, it moves in an optimistic direction. And at the end of the day, we are rooted in the scriptures. And really, what we feel doesn't matter. We want to acknowledge it and say, God, what do you say? Give us wisdom to know how to live and apply it in this present day, in this cultural context. Bless Fred as he opens the word, enables us to understand how to do this more fruitfully. As the people of God. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Fred, please.
Thanks, Greg. All right. Make sure this thing's... Oh, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for having me back. We are spending this conference time together reflecting on the changing culture and how to be wise in our pastoral and theological response to that culture. In our pre-conference, we started out with the eternal Trinity, the unchanging God, and we played around with like how you can't get any more relevant or less relevant than that, right? Because if we're talking about changing times, we go to this unchanging one, our rock and our fortress. And from that rock, we plunged into the flowing river of time of today, of the currents of change where we find ourselves swimming now. It's been an invigorating and a challenging conference, I think. But in this morning's session, by way of addressing what Greg talked about, I want to change our focus from time to place. And I think you'll see why I'm doing that as we try to think critically and in an informed way about where we are and who we are, and do that in a biblical way so that we don't just take things from the culture and decide, these are pretty nice, let's add a little Jesus to them and go with that, because you might end up accidentally doing the Crusades. So we're looking for tools to think more critically there. Culture is not mainly about when, but it's really about where, and we use the term culture in a lot of ways. It's a hard word to map how we use it or to figure out what any two people mean by the word, but I want to really focus on the idea of local culture, because you might notice a sort of level of abstraction when we talk about our culture, when we all converge here from multiple different places, and I've heard it in the discussion say, well, that might be how it is for you in Oregon, but it's really different in Illinois. You think, oh, okay. So it's meaningful to talk about today's culture and not name a place at all. It's also meaningful to talk about American culture or Western culture, which are these very vast things which tend us toward abstractions. So I'm going to try to think about more directly local culture. And the case study that I'll use throughout is going to be California, which might be, probably is, too big to say anything really specific about. We'll deal with that, right? But at least it's smaller than Western culture or today's culture, right? It's still big enough to make you say, wow, that's too complex to really say anything in a summary way about. But at least it's a starting point. It's getting us somewhere smaller. In order to be faithful to the everlasting gospel in our cultures, we need a deep understanding of the cultures that we are communicating with. So I want to start by talking about understanding the places and talking about theology with a local accent. Now, I read a lot of theology. Very little of it seems to be from anywhere in particular. You know what I mean? Pull down especially the big theology books, the big jumbo reference works of systematic theology that you might have on your shelf, and Try to figure out where that author's from. Skip the acknowledgments page that might have something remotely personal on it. And the rest of it, it really doesn't matter where that author was formed or lived or what specific context he's communicating in. We expect a kind of universal, sanitized tone of voice from our systematic theologies. That's okay, and some of that's appropriate to the fact that theological authors are trying to communicate very broadly. But I notice it's very different. With the music and the movies and the fiction that I enjoy, the best of them have some sense of place, of location, of origin. No matter what they're about, they're from somewhere, and they show signs of it. So you might even see a movie set in New York, but you can tell it's by a Los Angeles filmmaker, right? You might see a movie that's in Europe or Asia, but you can tell, oh, that's definitely a Hollywood sensibility brought to it. It's got a sense of where it's from. Then that can be good or bad, but I notice that other cultural productions, other ways of communication, are marked by a sense of where they're from. Even if they're talking about universal truths, these truths are spoken from a particular place, but not when it comes to theology. Very little localism shows up in any of the theology that I read, shows me any sign of where it's from. What I'd like to commend to you this morning is an approach to theology that attempts to speak from somewhere in particular and to make the most of that locatedness. I want to try to do theology with a local accent. I'm speaking primarily as an academic theologian, that's what I am, but I assume that everything I say is going to be relevant to you in your daily work as pastoral theologians, as frontline theologians. In fact, on this task, I assume that your work as pastoral theologians has you even more on the front lines of what a local culture is, even more embedded in the realities on the ground in your locations than an academic like me could be. So I'm going to address you from the level of academic theology, but my whole assumption here is not only that you can make your own translation to the pastoral, local, experienced theology level, but also that you've got a big advantage over academic theology. I've done this kind of talk at academic theological gatherings, and there is an odd sameness to academic theology. I mean, once a year I go to the big academic conference, and I see the same people every year now for 14 years, and we're always in a different major city, which are all really interesting, different locations, but we're always in convention centers in those cities, and I, for one, never leave them. I don't schedule an extra time to go do sightseeing, whether I'm in Baltimore or Philadelphia or whatever other, San Antonio, whatever city I want to see. I just sort of go there, and so as the years go by, I have this sense of, oh, here are my academic theology friends all wearing the same tweed jackets and walking down very similar kinds of hallways. So even there, I have a sense that I'm not anywhere. It's that airport feeling, you know what I mean? Like, you ever have those deja vu moments when you're walking down the jetway and you think, I don't remember where I am, and no signs around me in this built environment will clue me in. You know, you get on the corridors and there's a poster or something telling you, oh, it's London, I get it. But the jetways are all the same and the planes all feel the same. Anyway, trying to push back against that. Some of what I'm recommending here is just being a good citizen, and it comes natural to you, especially as pastors. It's just a matter of fitting in and not sticking out in the wrong way. You're bringing, in some ways, an odd, offensive, alien message to the modern world, the message of the cross and the scandal of the cross, but you want to do that in a way that what's offensive is the claims of Christ and not your inability to look like a normal person in that region. I'm not a big fan of spectator sports. It's not a gear that I've got. It's never come natural to me. You know, if a friend throws a Super Bowl party, I go over and try to have a good time. I remind myself which teams are playing, and I even take a little 3x5 card of things one should say during a big football game. That will move the chains, right? The only exception to this, though, was when I lived in central Kentucky for a number of years, where it was obvious to me what one ought to do to be a good citizen of central Kentucky, and that is love almost to the point of idolatry UK basketball. Okay. I mean, I'm so far from caring about spectator sports naturally that I'll just take my marching orders from the culture around me, where I thought, this is what I ought to do. I better love the Cats. If I don't, I'm just kind of a jerk. And the nice thing about it was the culture totally agreed. I mean, the wonderful thing about living in central Kentucky was I didn't have to decide, should I follow football or basketball? No, it was obvious. I mean, you were allowed to follow football and even care a lot about it while you were waiting for basketball season to start, right? But and I didn't have to worry, like, should I think about college ball or professional ball? Like, it was really obvious in Lexington, Kentucky, what you were supposed to do. I'd drive to the store sometimes, get out of the car and walk in, and little old ladies pushing shopping carts out would look at me and say, "Who's ahead?" Right? I mean, think about all the assumptions that are there. Like, here's an able-bodied, intelligent young man walking in. Clearly, he just got out of his car and was listening to the game. Right? So I can ask him a short question, "Who's ahead?" And I quickly learned, like, oh, I better know. Like, when little old ladies coming out of the store ask me who's ahead, I better not say, "Are you referring to a sporting event?" Right? So some of this is just fitting in. Now that I live in the L.A. area, I no longer follow any spectator sports because the culture doesn't have a consensus about what I should follow. You know what I mean? You can get little pockets of passionate sports fans in L.A., obviously, but they don't know which team you're supposed to follow. It's not even clear what sport you're supposed to care about. If the culture gives me a clear message, I will obey, because I like to fit in, and I like to have something to talk about. And, you know, you can only talk about the weather so long. Sports is great for conversation. Anyway, so some of this is going to come natural to you, but throughout this talk, I'm going to be using examples from my own location, California, and I'm doing this because it's what I know, because I want to be concrete rather than general. That's the whole point. And because I think I can trust you to apply these lessons to your own locations. Also because I'm trying to model and exemplify the kind of theology I'm talking about. At the end, I'll say a little bit about a collaborative project called Theological Engagement with California Culture. But for now, bear with me as I just keep interjecting Californian motifs into this talk. I want to read you the opening paragraph of East of Eden. It's a big novel. Listen to how John Steinbeck, let me give you a picture of him there. Old grumpy old man Steinbeck. How John Steinbeck opens this famous novel. So just a little bit from the opening page of East of Eden. The Salinas Valley in Northern California, It is a long, narrow swell between two ranges of mountains, and the Salinas River winds and twists up the center until it falls at last into Monterey Bay. I remember my childhood names for grasses and secret flowers. I remember where a toad may live, and what time the birds awaken in the summer, and what trees and seasons smelled like, how people looked and walked and smelled even. The memory of odors is very rich. I remember that the Gabalon Mountains to the east of the valley were light, gay mountains full of sun and loveliness and a kind of invitation, so that you wanted to climb into their warm foothills almost as you want to climb into the lap of a beloved mother. They were beckoning mountains with a brown grass love. The Santa Lucias stood up against the sky to the west and kept the valley from the open sea, and they were dark and brooding, unfriendly and dangerous. I always found in myself a dread of west and a love of east. Where I ever got such an idea, I cannot say, unless it could be that the morning came over the peaks of the Gabalons and the night drifted back from the ridges of the Santa Lucias. It may be that the birth and death of the day had some part in my feeling about the two ranges of mountains. From both sides of the valley, little streams slipped out of the hill canyons and fell into the bed of the Salinas River. In the winter of wet years, the streams ran full freshet, and they swelled the river until sometimes it raged and boiled, bank full, and then it was a destroyer. The river tore the edges of the farmlands and washed whole acres down. It toppled barns and houses into itself to go floating and bobbing away. It trapped cows and pigs and sheep and drowned them in its muddy brown water and carried them to the sea. Then when the late spring came, the river drew in from its edges and the sandbanks appeared. And in the summer, the river didn't run at all above ground. Some pools would be left in the deep swirl places under a high bank. The tules and the grasses grew back, and willows straightened up with the flood debris in their upper branches. The Salinas was only a part-time river. The summer sun drove it underground. It was not a fine river at all, but it was the only one we had, so we boasted about it. How dangerous it was in a wet winter, how dry it was in a dry summer. You can boast about anything if it's all you have. Maybe the less you have, the more you're required to boast. The floor of the Salinas Valley, between the ranges and below the foothills, is level, because this valley used to be the bottom of a 100-mile inlet from the sea. The river mouth at Moss Landing was centuries ago the entrance of this long inland water. Once, 50 miles down the valley, my father bored a well. The drill came up first with topsoil, and then with gravel, and then with white sea sand full of shells and pieces of whalebone. There were 20 feet of sand and then black earth again, and even a piece of redwood, that imperishable wood that does not rot. Before the inland sea, the valley must have been a forest, and those things that had happened right under our feet. And it seemed to me sometimes at night that I could feel both the sea and the redwood forest before it. Now, it goes on from there, but this is a classic opening to East of Eden. Notice the kind of understanding that Steinbeck brings to this. He goes wide and he goes deep. He looks to the mountain ridges on either side of the valley that he grew up in, and he talks about them as sort of representing something further out, you know, that they are east and west to him, and he has emotional associations with them. It really is a view of the world as wide as you can look from east to west, from sunrise to sundown. So with that reference to the sun, he sort of expands the horizons beyond Earth itself, right? He's going into sort of phenomena in space, but it's all having to do with these two mountain ranges. And he even talks about, I was kind of a kid, and I might have had silly associations, but, you know, the eastern mountains were friendly and the western mountains were scary. So he's kind of taking in the whole world, but it's really about his little world. And then he sings the praises of the river, which is so dangerous at first, and he tells you it's killing cows and toppling barns. But then later he admits, yeah, it's probably not really much of a river. It's kind of a part-time river, and but it's all we had, so we boasted about it. You know, so he's kind of going big, going small, going big, going small all the time. And then what I think is a masterstroke is the very end of this paragraph, he describes the boring of a well. And all of a sudden, you're no longer going out with those geographic coordinates, but you're going down, which is simultaneously going back in time. And so he's telling you what comes up as the drill bit turns and is bringing up different parts. You know, so much dry white sand and then redwood, which brings in this California evocation of these great forests, you know, that we have in the north, but you wouldn't really expect down in the Salinas Valley. But he's saying, if you time travel, if you dig deep enough here, it's all represented here. Well, that's Steinbeck. I'm actually not a big Steinbeck fan, but I have to recognize, man, this opening is great. And I also think that if you give Steinbeck enough pages, he can really get something done. I read a bunch of short Steinbeck a while ago and hated it so bad I swore I would never read Steinbeck again. But I warmed up to it and I thought, well, I'm going to read one of those big jumbo 1,000-pager novels. And if you give him enough room, he can really get something done. His motto as a writer was, "To the stars on the wings of a pig." And I think that's good self-knowledge. He's really kind of a rough guy. There's nothing subtle about this, right? I mean, especially when I set it up by talking about localism, you go, wow, Steinbeck is just doing that thing you're talking about. He's trying to describe his consciousness of the world in a local way, in Californian terms, and it's even almost corny. It's almost too obvious that he says, then we drilled down and did a study of California history. But again, I think it works really wonderfully. And I want to suggest that in terms of embeddedness in place, Steinbeck got it right. Now, for our task of thinking theologically, Steinbeck is kind of a model and kind of a warning, because there is a theology running through East of Eden, if you know it at all, even from the James Dean movie, which is only like the first 100 pages of the novel or something like that. It's really a story, a retelling of the Cain and Abel story. It's two brothers, East of Eden, and they're contending with each other, partly about their father's love, and Steinbeck is... He retells that Cain and Abel story over and over and over again. Two generations at least play it out with characters whose names sound a lot like Cain and Abel. And then, again, Steinbeck's not subtle. So some Chinese immigrants in San Francisco learn Hebrew so they can study the Cain and Abel story and have big arguments about it in Chinatown. And it all comes down to sort of the interpretation of this one Hebrew word. So Steinbeck's doing a very theological thing, except his theology is terrible. I think he's an atheist. He has no real hope, but he's fascinated in the Bible story and how the Bible story overlays the California story. So he is telling the story of California and telling it inside of the story of Scripture. Now again, theologically speaking, I don't think he's doing it well. If you break it out of the narrative framework and say, what does he believe doctrinally? I don't like what he believes doctrinally. But he's a model of doing it well, even the theological task, Right? He's even taking the California story and reading it into the Bible story so that they inform each other. I want to move on from this. That's just kind of the opening riff of how to do this project. Hey there. I want to talk about two different theological methods. Speaking of drilling down here, I'm going to go a little bit deep into the methodological question of how we do theology. And I want to point to two examples, a method of correlation and a method of proclamation. I want to distinguish between the two methods. Correlation on the one hand, which could take culture either as either a norm or a source for theology, and then programmatic apologetics on the other hand, which investigates the culture in order to communicate its message most effectively. These are both methods of correlation. And your big example of the method of correlation is Paul Tillich, mid-century German theologian who ended up working in America. The present movement towards developing theological localism is a third thing, so we'll get to that and we'll talk about it later. It's neither correlation nor proclamation, but I'm kind of recommending another thing that tries to get the best of both worlds. While rejecting correlationism, theological localism attempts to take into account the fact that theological thinking is embedded in the cultural forms that it's addressing. That is to say, we're not just standing out here talking to the culture, we're in and formed by and participating in the culture. And so trying to recognize that. Within the bounds of orthodoxy, there's a good laudable diversity of equally legitimate local theologies that we can develop, that have been developed all throughout Christian history, and that we can develop in our own areas. Now, the method of correlation, or correlationism, is an approach to theology that gives equal weight to human cultural questions and to biblical theological answers. So correlation, it's always about two terms and putting them together. Tillich was its great advocate, and speaking of theological disasters like Steinbeck, Tillich's even worse. I read through his three-volume systematic theology in grad school, and things were going okay in volume one, but then in volume two we get to the Christology, and what he says about Jesus made me almost shred the book. Still, I'm using him as partly a cautionary tale, but he's the king of this method of correlation. Tillich developed it as a method of explaining the contents of the Christian faith through aligning existential questions and theological answers in mutual correspondence. So here's what Tillich said about it. Philosophy formulates the questions implied in human existence. This is the job of philosophy, not of Christian theology, but philosophers ought to look at human existence and formulate the questions that emerge out of human existence. And then theology formulates the answers implied in human existence. Now, Tillich was not the first practitioner of correlationism. It's at least as old as classical liberal theology from about 1800. And if Tillich is to be believed, it is as old as theology itself. Tillich says, "We have not invented a new method, but have rather tried to make explicit the implications of old ones, namely, the implications of apologetic theology." And this is the good part of Tillich. He said of his own work, "Since the split between a faith unacceptable to culture and a culture unacceptable to faith is not possible for me, the only alternative was to attempt to interpret the symbols of faith through the expressions of our own culture." The result of this attempt was his three volumes of systematic theology and a bunch of other books that were popular mid-century, books like A Theology of Culture. Now, the method of correlation, and the key idea here, is philosophy looks at human existence and raises the questions. Theology then brings the answers. Yeah, so it's you ask the questions, we'll bring the answers. That should describe some part of a theological ministry, right? But here's where Tillich goes with it. It's perennially attractive for theologians of culture. It marks out a clear arena in which culture can make itself heard in theology. It raised theological reflection on culture to a higher level by making it an explicit topic of discussion and by sanctioning this project of a theology of culture. But already in Tillich's own work, the method showed itself to be unstable. Tillich claimed that culture was neither a source nor a norm of theology. We don't get our doctrine from it. But it proved difficult for him to keep it out of that space. When Tillich was writing, the word experience, back in the 50s and 60s, had a lot more cachet. And Tillich drew a line there saying, experience cannot be a source or a norm for theology. But the theologians who learned the most from Tillich and carried out his task of reading their cultures theologically and learning their theology culturally usually drew the opposite conclusion. They said, "Thank you very much, Tillich, for the method of correlation. We think experience, though, can be a source and a norm of theology." So in that next generation after Tillich, it became standard for theologians of culture to admit categories like experience and culture into their canons of doctrine. both as norms and as sources. So you know what I'm talking about at the popular level, people who have an experience and say, this lets me know exactly what must be true. This puts boundaries on what I may believe as doctrinally. Two other weaknesses of correlationist theology. First, only with great difficulty can a correlationist break through the grid of presuppositions built into the questions raised by a culture. And unless you break through that grid of presuppositions that raise the questions, you're stuck with questions no better than that grid permits. Often theology's task, though, isn't to announce to a culture that it's not just missing the answers, but asking the wrong questions. Right? So it's not just to say, hi, I'm a theologian. Do you have questions? Oh, good, I've got answers. And then you play the matching game of correlationism. You actually show up sometimes and say, wow, not only does this culture not have the answers, they don't even know the questions. They're not even asking, and the ones they're asking are so misleading, we'll never get to the answers. Correlationism doesn't really allow for that. Framing a question is often more important than answering it, or at least it's more determinative for the bounds of the conversation. Again, my main job is teaching in a Socratic style in the Torrey Honors Institute at Biola, and for a 3-hour class session with undergrads, I'm not supposed to make any categorical definitive statements. We've got a classic book we've read, and I'm supposed to start the class by asking the right question that starts the dialogue. Now, students know what I believe. I'm on the record, I'm in print saying what I believe, but through the course of the class, I'm the one sort of posing the questions. And if I had to choose between question and answers for the education process, I would choose the questions. Because if I can ask the right questions, I can trust the students, I can trust the text they've read, and I can pray like crazy while making polite eye contact with the students, I think we'll get to the right place, right? There's also, of course, a place for standing up and just saying the answers from the front of the room. So for every unit that our students are registered for, we require them to go to one one-hour lecture where someone stands at the front and says, behold, these things are true, write them down, and you say things. But there's lots and lots of hours of asking the questions and getting there. Second, correlationists, this is another weakness of correlationist theology, they tend to hurry past the task of describing and elaborating Christian truth, assuming that the proper business of theology is cultural theology. A correlationist's sense of excitement and its sense of project tends to come from combining theology with the next thing, as if the descriptive and elaborative task of Christian doctrine could be presupposed as already accomplished. There's kind of a boredom with theology among correlationists. They say like, yeah, blah, 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 doctrine, yada, yada, yada. But what about doctrine and they're excited about the and. There's an alienation of affections there that you can hear in a lot of correlationist theology, where I'm going to say, you know, you make it sound like all the cool, exciting stuff is over here where the cultural questions are raised. What if I just wanted to obsess about the Trinity for 5 or 6 decades? Would that be okay? Not the Trinity and anything necessarily, just camp out right there in a core Christian doctrine and assume my task of understanding and redescribing this revealed thing is not done. I may go out and do some correlating, but it's not because I've done this task and I'm ready to move on. You never finish the descriptive confessional task of Christian doctrine. The result is correlationists generally approach their task with an unnecessarily minimized or thin theology. Now, Tillich contrasted correlationism with the theology of proclamation, and both of these guys got on the cover of Time magazine, so they used to be a big deal. The big example here was Karl Barth. According to Tillich, the theology of proclamation wants to hurl the Christian message like a brick at the head of its audience. This was not, of course, really fair to the theology of proclamation. It's not even fair to Karl Barth. Even if proclaimers were interested in doing so, they might, after all, want to know more about the brick they are throwing and the head at which they are throwing it. One could imagine a theology of our culture or of California culture that sought better and better information about the Californian head at which it is hurling its gospel brick. Which brings us to programmatic apologetics, still on the correlation side. Tillich called his own method not only correlationism, but he called it apologetic theology, by which he meant a theology that helped modern people answer questions, from the Greek word apologia, a word in response, an answer that's given. But in our time, apologetics also names a discipline of recommending and defending the truth claims of Christianity in a public forum. In its advocacy for Christian truth claims, programmatic apologetics, like a system of apologetics, is a really interesting, it's really interested in the plausibility structures of the target culture. Apologists are always having to ask the question, what will today's culture find believable? and kind of weighing the options. Like, well, they don't find this very believable, so let's lead with the part that's more plausible to them. Those engaged in apologetics investigate culture in order to communicate their own message to it with maximal effectiveness. Apologetics has some of the same weaknesses of correlationism, a tendency to let the world set the terms of the debate, a tendency to assume that the world knows the right questions to ask, and we're going to bring the persuasive answers. But apologetics is also threatened by the opposite danger of failing to notice that the apologist is part of the world that he's attempting to persuade, that he can never simply speak to the culture from somewhere else, but always is already speaking from within the culture, even though he's bringing a truly alien word revealed from God. And also the theologian or the apologist is one formed by the culture. We are who we are because of the culture that we find ourselves in. So now theological localism is something slightly different from either correlationism or systematic apologetics or the proclamation. I have a short statement of it. Let me just say this is not really fair to either Bart or Tillich, but I'm using them as kind of placeholders. Let me also say, I'm not going to say, well, there's correlation on one side and proclamation on the other, and we should find a middle compromise. This is not one of the areas where I think the middle compromise area is right. For my money, I want to learn what is to be learned from correlationism, but I reject that as a theological method. Proclamation, I think, is closer to the truth. It's just proclamation where you're not a blockhead, right? It's proclamation where you're actually sensitive to what the message is and who you're communicating it with. I recently read a book about Karl Barth's. He taught a preaching class in 1932, 1933 in Bonn, Germany, right as the National Socialist movement was really crystallizing, you know, 32, 33. So he's teaching these young German pastors, and he refuses to address current politics. For one thing, he's a Swiss citizen, and as soon as he's caught saying anything subversive, he's kicked out. He's not in great personal danger at the time, but he wants to stay in Germany teaching German pastors to try to make a difference. And people would ask him, like, why are you just teaching normal, regular preaching? Why is it all about exegesis and getting the message of the Bible? Why don't you relate this to current events? And he said, nope, I'm going to go on teaching preaching as if nothing had happened. That was his motto. He was kind of proud of that, like, as if nothing has happened. Other people have made fun of him and said, you know, pretty much the Nazi German thing is forming around you, and you should have spoken a prophetic word to it. And he said, that's not how it works. This is what I like about Barth's theology of preaching. He said, you know how if you're studying like ancient hieroglyphs or something, you stare at it really hard, and as you're staring and trying to make sense of it, your lips might move a little? You're going, he says, that's preaching. That's what you're doing. You're staring so hard at the text, you're so engrossed in understanding it and hearing what the word of the Lord is in the words of this text that your lips move a little bit while you're reading that hard, and that's the sermon. Now, it's an overstatement, right? But it's a really graphic image of I'm not sitting here thinking about my audience like, gee, I wonder what people think. No, I'm focused on the Word of God, and good communication then happens. So anyway, I'm not putting a middle ground here, but I'm going to put it here visually in the middle and point out to you. An art historian at Wheaton, Matthew Milliner, has talked about theolocalism. I call it theological localism, though theolocalism is easier to Google. Here's what he goes, six quick theses about theolocalism, which is a method I'm commending here. When biblical and Nicene theological norms have been sufficiently internalized, theology can encourage unique regional developments. So notice, we're talking about something small, lest I give you a sense that this is a whole new way of doing all of theology. Milliner says here, well, no, the Bible's the norm, and then there's even some normative claims of Christian tradition, so Nicene theology, sort of some crystallized, canonized doctrines like the doctrine of the Trinity, two natures of Christ. Once you've got that framework, like it's got to be in the Bible, and it's got to be sort of in continuity with the great church tradition. But then there's legitimate localism that can be encouraged, unique regional developments, such that you could say, you know, Swiss theology is a little different from actual French theology, and that's very different from German theology. We can actually make these kinds of statements about the old world. It's American theology that hasn't really taken on this sort of regional development. Second thesis, localist efforts to combat modern transience should therefore infect theological method. Now, what's he talking about here? You know, it's the thing where in American culture, we tend to all shop at the same kinds of stores. And every time I go somewhere new, I think, this will be really different and unique and kind of a strange regional place. And you get there, and all the McDonald's are the same, and the news anchors speak unaccented English. And you think, kind of be neater if I went to Massachusetts and couldn't understand anybody, right? Like, and if they didn't have McDonald's, they had some weird New England-y thing that I don't know anything about, right? But there's this kind of sameness that makes us feel more transient, like you could go anywhere and be anywhere and doesn't make any difference. So there's a real hunger for a sense of rootedness, not to give us ultimate meaning, but to just give us a sense that we are somewhere. And Milner's saying, we should also have that in theology. Third thesis, if a given place hasn't yet made a theological contribution, it should consider doing so. I like the way Milner puts this, right? It's not, you must develop a theology from where you are. He said, no, but if your region doesn't have an accent, doesn't have a theological point of view that's been expressed or a tone, yeah, you should consider that. You know, look into it. See if there is one you could develop. Fourth, theological localism means thinking with those closest to you. Sort of a 100-mile intellectual diet. Right? So that might be a little trendy, but you know, the 100-mile diet, the local diet, where you think, what if I ate more of what grew in my region instead of eating stuff that's all from Chile? You know, like why do I have grapes growing in the valley next to me, but the ones I eat are from South America? That's kind of weird, and I know that there are geographical and economic reasons for how all of that works, but this kind of 100-mile diet fad, which I do not at all participate in, but I'm interested in, and I also think, what if my main theological dialogue partners were local to me? What if I said I can really only read books by people whose house I can walk to? That would be too small, and it wouldn't work in LA because you'd get run over, but something like that. Number five, I think, is just a restatement of number four, but it's kind of cute. What theologians thought matters, but so does where they are buried. I've thought about this as a side project. I'm an amateur historian of the history of Biola University, and we have the founders that came out and started Biola, you know, around 1908. R.A. Torrey and his wife were sent back to their ancestral eastern home to be buried. So you can go see their burial site there. Lyman Stewart was sent back to his Stewart homestead to be buried. T.C. Horton and his wife Anna are buried right there in Los Angeles. And I'm not a big pilgrimage to gravesites kind of person, but there's something interesting about that. I feel like the Hortons actually moved to Biola. They actually came to L.A., and maybe at some point they stopped referring to it as out here and just started calling it here. You know what I mean? There's one kind of immigrant mindset that always thinks of, you know, well, here we are in California, way out here. And then others have sort of reset and said, it's not out here, it's just here. So where they are buried, I think that's kind of a cute way to put it. I wouldn't really hold myself to that strictly. And then the sixth point, this is not to be nativist, but to exploit native resources for the sake of the universal church. So again, we're not starting a school of theology that's in opposition to other ones, but is to say we're all trying to do theology about universal things and serve the universal church, but it would be cool if some parts of the theological world had distinctive accents. Now, theological localism is a commitment to regional intellectual resources, both in terms of drawing on them and of contributing to them. So to start with a reading diet, you know, where if you're in Kansas City, you could say, are there Kansas City theologians? Is there such a thing? What would that look like? And are they good or bad? And is this a heritage that we should embrace and cultivate? Or are there local, regional, territorial demons that need to be exorcised before we can actually do anything with this area? Now, applied to California, the overall task is somewhere between a theology of California, a theology of or about California, and theology from California. Those would be the two bumper stickers if I were to kind of describe this. The former, theology of California, indicates bringing theological reflection to bear on that entity which is California, to offer a theological account of its existence and character. So that's the theology about California, you could say. But then theology from California indicates that we're doing theological reflection about the usual suspects, Revelation, God, creation, providence, humanity, but we're doing it in this particular location, intentionally cultivating resources that are local and native. Okay, I'm going to move a little bit quicker here. Bye, Bart and Tillich. I'm going to talk about taking action. So, I mean, that's enough theory, and I thought it'd be fun to start your morning with some high-flying theological method theory. But to apply this a little bit more, I call this section Taking Action, Men of Issachar in Every Place. And, of course, I'm picking up on the men of Issachar that are mentioned in 1 Chronicles 12:32. It's just numbering all the different tribes, and it says, of Issachar, 200 chiefs and all their kinsmen, but then it just stops and says this one little thing in the census about the men of Issachar. It says, they were men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. And that's what we're really looking for at this whole conference, right? We want to be men who have understanding of the times and know what is to be done. We don't just want general speculative knowledge so that we have comprehensive understanding of all things. We want to know where we are and when we are and what needs to be done now. So out of my list of 50 good things that ought to be done, I want to know what actions are to be taken at this time. What ought Israel to do now? And so we're trying to cultivate men of Issachar. I want to look at one other example. This is a book that I think models this pretty well in terms of the cultural situation and the way a people understands itself. It's a 2007 book by Curtis Chang from InterVarsity Press. I think it might still be in print from Whip and Stock, but it initially came out from InterVarsity. A Captivating Strategy from Augustine and Aquinas. Now, I teach great books for a living, so I would like something that points to Augustine and Aquinas as the role models. I'm just going to talk about Augustine, or if you prefer, Augustine. I don't care which one. Whichever you say, though, I'll correct you and raise my eyebrow meaningfully, so it gives me the rhetorical advantage. Like, oh, you mean Augustine? No, it really doesn't matter. So Chang wrote this book, A Captivating Strategy from Augustine and Aquinas. And he says, here's what both of these guys did. So Augustine, he died around the year 430, and he's in North Africa, definitely in the Roman imperial context, towards the very end, right? The barbarians are at the gate, and Rome's about to go down. And then Aquinas, who dies around the year 1274, who's in Italy and in Rome and Paris and is a Dominican teacher. So he's definitely medieval Christendom Europe. Focusing on Augustine, though, and especially his book, City of God, here's what Augustine does. He is a Roman. He's proud to be a Roman. He's a professor of rhetoric at a Roman university. And he writes the City of God to explain why Rome seems to be crumbling. Because the charge is brought, you Christians are terrible citizens. And as soon as Rome went Christian and forsook the old pagan gods that we were built on, everything started falling apart. And Augustine thinks, no, I'm actually a good citizen of Rome. I'm a better citizen of heaven. And that's why he kind of develops this whole big fat book, The City of God, about, you know, we live in these two cities. We live in the city of God, but we live in the city of man. Our citizenship, our conversation, Philippians says, is in heaven. And yet we're also really here and actually committed to the good of the city. So it's sort of sad when Rome falls, because Rome, they built really good roads, you know, and they had a good police force, so you could go from city to city without getting mugged. And when barbarians tried to take over, Rome had a big army and they fought it off. So there's some good stuff about Rome. But as Rome is falling, what should Christians think? Are we alarmed? Do we think, oh no, we had the kingdom of God on earth and now it's all over? No, Augustine stood back and took a bigger picture view of it and said, no, kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall. We should know to expect that from Scripture. And so if Rome's a good thing and it falls, well, that's sad. A lot of us will probably be hacked down by barbarians as this great peaceful city falls. But then he gets further inside, and this is what Chang points to as the captivating strategy. Augustine really knows his Roman classics, like Virgil, the Aeneid, all of this stuff about the founding of Rome. He gets inside of that story and starts retelling it. And he says, but you know those armies that keep us safe from barbarians and all that? They actually exist because Rome was driven by a lust to dominate. So this Pax Romana, this great global peace that Rome brought about, it actually only works because Rome appointed itself the boss and killed anyone who disagreed. So what we experience as peace inside of Rome is actually this lustful desire to conquer the world. And if you think about it, and he quotes this line from Virgil's Aeneid, where the founder of Rome, Aeneas, goes into the underworld and he meets his departed father there, and his father tells him stuff about the future, and he says, Your destiny, O Roman, is to battle down the proud and to pardon the humble. That's what you're going to do. You're going to go out there, Rome, and you're going to battle down all the proud. If those Germans mess with you, you just knock them down. But then if they humble themselves, meaning we admit you're Rome, you're the greatest, well, then you pardon them. Augustine gets that and he says, this is your self-understanding, Empire of Rome. You're going to battle down the proud and pardon the humble. But in the Bible, I find that God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. And I actually hear Rome deifying itself and arrogating to its own self-understanding a theological understanding and claiming to be God. So in that sense, Rome is actually demonic. Rome is actually putting itself in place as an idolatrous, false god, as a replacement for God. So it's interesting how Augustine does this, and he takes, you know, 1,000 pages to do it, so it's a great big fat City of God book. But he doesn't just yell at Rome from outside. He really takes on the self-understanding of Rome and the story that Rome tells about who it is, and he out-narrates it. Like, he retells the story, but he adds God to it. And once you let God into the story of Rome, it throws a very different light on what Rome is. So Chang recommends this as a captivating strategy, that is to really live in the story that a culture is telling about itself until you understand it. And then to begin to re-narrate that story, but without leaving God out this time. Retelling a culture's own story from the inside, but including the theological element. So it's really kind of a storytelling contest. But you have to assume that the stories we tell ourselves about who we are as a people really matter. Now, some of this has been done for American history. There are interpretations of American history that try to understand kind of the providential place of America. And if you think about the major stories about American self-identity, you can think about some of the negotiations that have been brought there. You know, is America the new Israel as God takes his errand into the wilderness to convert the savages there? Well, that's some of the understanding of the original American colonists, and some of the preachers bought into that and said, yes, we are. God has chosen. We're the new chosen people. And then some of them got their eschatology worked out a little bit better and said, actually, we're not the new chosen people in anything except a very metaphorical sense. Let's understand instead what we're doing here in the new world as an outpost of what God's work is. So anyway, a storytelling contest that Chang points to some ancient examples of and then says, we ought to do that. Now, I want to leave time for questions here, so what I'm going to cut to is a description of the project that I've been working on for a while called Theological Engagement with California Culture. But I think you see why I'm doing it and that I'm saying it ought to happen in lots of places. Why did I pick California? Because I'm in California. Why did I pick something as big as California? Because it's a really nebulous entity, you know. I used to tease my wife when we would play Pictionary. When we lived in Kentucky, we'd play Pictionary, and you'd get a card. We had to say something about the U.S. She would draw the U.S. She'd draw this lovely little New England and go down the coast and get a Florida that was quite recognizable. And most of Texas was pretty recognizable. And then as soon as she got west of Texas, she just went loop and went up and then went back over to New England across the Canadian border. And I'd point to this, and I'd say, how is that the U.S.? And everyone else would look at it and say, yeah, that's the United States. And I'd say, the American West is so big. Like what is there west of Texas is so gigantic. It's just mind-blowing. And California is sort of like that. You look at it and think, what's the current proposal that they've revived? It should be 7 states. I mean, everyone knows it should at least be 2 states. And it's like when they were roughing in what was going to be the California state, they didn't have enough pencil lead to make lots of divisions or something, so they just made it one gigantic, enormous state. But you could sort of subdivide it into regions in some other meaningful way and get about 7 states out of it. There's a sense in which California is too big to talk about it having a culture. In this theological engagement with California culture, we like that because we want to use it as kind of a test case or a limiting case. But I'm also into a really micro-local thing, so I'm working on a little fun project with my kids of mapping every tree on the campus of Biola University. Talking about and telling the story of every tree. Because, you know, the campus has only been there 50 years. Every tree there was planted by human design. It's a 95-acre campus. And so I thought, that'd be kind of cool. What if we had intimate knowledge of every single tree occupying this 95 acres? So we're working on that. That's micro-local, and only a handful of people will ever care about that. But But there are lots of interesting things. Like there's like about 150 olive trees, and they're all numbered with little dog tags, and I'm trying to find the story about that. Except tree number one is missing, so therein lies a mystery. Yeah. So the micro-local thing is really valuable, and if you're in a very small town, you don't have to think, I'm going to have to do a theology of this entire region. You may have a story right there. You probably don't have published theologians who have done stuff, but there is an implicit local theology waiting to be drawn out. So here's what I want to do as a really rough sketch. Theological engagement with California culture is a multi-year, multidisciplinary project that we've been working on. Got a couple of grants for it, and we've had a couple of gatherings. Got another one coming up in April in Berkeley. My partner on the project has been Jason Sexton. He's a California EFCA church planner and a theologian. And we've got a book coming out, I think later this year, from Ashgate. I can't remember the name of it. Something about California theology. And what I want to give you is just, there's numerous chapters here. I just want to give you a little bit of what's in my chapter 10, Is There a Theology of California? And here's how I'm going to do that. I'm going to work through, very briefly, just a few sentences each, the major doctrines of systematic theology and try to describe kind of the California thing with them. So the doctrine of revelation. Oh, did I do the doctrine of God? Wow, that's a hard one. Let's skip that a second. Doctrine of Revelation. The question of how God takes the initiative to make himself known to human creatures is fundamental for any theology. The doctrine of Revelation is sometimes subdivided between general revelation and special revelation. General revelation is said to be the way God reveals himself in universally available structures of creation. California, with its exaggerated consciousness of the natural world, is sometimes inclined to hear the voice of God in nature. But the God who speaks through the landscape and weather of the Pacific coast is notoriously nonspecific as deities go. Such a God is usually simply the universe, a deity some Californians talk about with a flatness that would make pantheists yearn for something more specific. I was in a bookstore in Berkeley and I heard the lady in the next aisle over say, "Ah, here's the book. I knew the universe wanted me to find it." And I almost went over and said, "Let me tell you what the universe thinks about you." The problem perhaps lies in the very category of general revelation, which presupposes that whenever created things testify of God, that testimony is to be understood as God's own self-testimony, that is, as revelation. It's possible that Christian theology in Californian categories would have incentive to call into question some of the received opinions about general revelation. Is it God talking to us through things, or is it things talking about God? Materials for a Californian treatment of special revelation would call on many disciplines, but what would be especially interesting is a history of Bible interpretation in California, including how Scripture has been taken to support or challenge imperialism, manifest destiny, and westward expansion. Let me just jump to the doctrine of creation, since we're kind of on that topic. Historian Kevin Starr has noted how a certain awareness of the natural world is a constant theme in California intellectual, artistic, and cultural life. Starr says, a streak of nature worship, sometimes sentimental, sometimes neo-pagan in its intensity, sometimes zen-like, runs through the imaginative, intellectual, and moral history of California as a fixed reference point of social identity. A society that has consumed nature so wantonly and ferociously is paradoxically nature's most ardent advocate. So the whole idea of national parks is invented in California. And then the last thing I want to do is the doctrine of anthropology. What is California man that thou art mindful of him? We might ask God. The provincial theologian could ask that. For some observers, the human project seems to be particularly on display and at stake in California. If California is America, only more so, is what Wallace Stegner called it. Like, California, it's America, only more so. And if America is focusing and radicalizing Western traditions, then the proper study of California mankind is man. Philosopher Josiah Royce pointed out in his Pacific Coast essay, there's a particular mindset formed in California. Intimacy with nature means a certain change in your relations to your fellow men. You get a sense of power, Royce says, from these wide views, a habit of personal independence, from the contemplation of a world that the eye seems to own. There's a habit of personal independence manifested sometimes in an acute self-consciousness that what humans do is secrete culture. There's a kind of awareness. Everyone's making culture all the time. There's an awareness in California that we're making culture on purpose. Okay, I'm going to close there. Just wanted to give you a glimpse of the fact that each of these loci of systematic theology could be developed with a certain local or regional influence, using local resources and speaking with a local accent. We've talked a lot about understanding the times and responding well to the culture. What I wanted to throw in the mix here, sort of building on what Richard Lentz had said, is a set of tools for describing a local culture in a way that's helpful and usable for our task of responding and taking action. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Fred, very much. You can see, hang on, we'll take some questions.
Okay.
Yeah, we will.
Right,
and what we're going to do is we're going to go into our panel time. I think it's important to, you know, to address some of these issues. This is a pretty significant issue today, especially as you're reading the contextual theology and it's, you know, you can hear it from Fred, who has studied this. You'll see his work that's coming out that focuses on California culture. But it's a pretty significant issue for us to consider and ponder. There are also a number of works. I mean, so often it seems that here in America, the idea was that whatever we would do, though local, it would be universalized. Hmm. It's been criticized, appropriately so. But now it's as if in the criticism, we almost have nothing to say but local. You know, so it's only situational.
Yeah.
There's a downside to that. The plus side is now you get commentaries on African theology and some of these books that are being written. And what you'd find amazing is, depending upon one's position of the scriptures, conclusions are often similar, though applications will be a bit different. Hmm. So demon possession. We won't read that often in our books. You will there. So it's a significant issue. Thank you very much for bringing this. Now, what kinds of questions might you have as a pastor called to theolocalism, doing theology locally? What questions might you have? Here's one back here. And as he's thinking about this, why don't you tell them, since you like to ask the questions, tell them the questions they should be asking. Right here. Thank you.
Aren't we really talking about relational theology? In other words, you were in Kentucky.
Yeah.
You weren't a basketball fan, and I don't understand that, but and you learned to relate.
Yeah.
So with our theology, we all have our theology, and we will die for it. But we have to learn to relate. And isn't kind of the whole thing a relational theology?
Yeah, I think that's right. Especially the smaller you get in your localist circle, the more it's about just being a good neighbor, right? So I really am ready to not have a lawn. You know, I think lawns are just crazy in Los Angeles, and I think with this current drought, we're going to all notice. We notice it every few years. Like, we shouldn't have lawns out here. I'd love to get rid of my lawn, but I also want to be a good neighbor. And I know that Bob and Maggie down the road would hate me if I dryscaped my front yard. So I'm trying to come up with a compromise, you know, where I use a lot less water but just have a little ridge of green out at the... So there's that. And in making that decision, just because I don't want to irritate Bob and Maggie any more than I already do, I'm actually making some interesting decisions about L.A. culture as a whole, right? But it all starts with being a good neighbor. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. The bigger you get, the more you broaden that locale, the more the task takes on sort of theoretic constraints. And also, depending on where you are, some cultures know what to celebrate already, and there are plenty of cultures, especially small towns, which don't quite get what's special about them. I think Wendell Berry's written a lot about small communities needing to learn to be the center of their own attention and not always think of themselves as outpost of the nearest large city where all the cool stuff really is, but actually to be able to say, you know, what's here in this small location? It's good enough. It's us. It's what, you know, like Steinbeck said, if all you've got is that one river, you'll boast about that river. Well, that's a healthy impulse. You know, not to be bigoted about it and say, our river's the best river ever, but to admit. It's why I do a lot of amateur history of Biola. I don't think Biola is the center and goal of all God's ways and works in the world, but I think we're pretty cool, and it's since I've joined that faculty, it's my story to tell. It's like what I always tell What I always tell grooms in premarital counseling is, your wife has all these virtues, and it's your job to be the one who sings those praises, right? Like, no one else is going to do it, and if you don't, they will go unrecognized, unsung, uncelebrated. Yeah, there's something like that with where we are too. Yeah. Other regions are way too high on themselves and need to be told, "You're not that great." Right? Yeah.
There was another. Yes, right here, Dan.
So, are you basically talking about doing an ethnology of the culture in which we live, the particular culture? And if so, obviously a little more specific, not a broad ethnology, but a theological ethnology. And if so, what are some practical, like, where would you start in terms of the first, you know, couple things you would do? Because obviously there's a list of 100 things to do in ministry that require attention every week, or, you know, but to know the sheep and to know the town and to know the culture is important. But
yeah, good. Ethnology is a great tool here. And something I left out of this version of the paper is church planters, I think, get this, right? You don't just flip a coin to decide where you're going to put the church or how you're going to position the church or anything like that. There's a really intense amount of analysis of the people there before you begin doing that thing. So one thing I would say is, you could think of the church that you're in as always being in sort of ethnological church planting mode. Like, you're always kind of replanting the church by always refreshing your understanding of what's around you. But yeah, I mean, as I'm looking at this in an interdisciplinary way, I think, who is actually doing this? And when I look at certain church planters and the kind of research that goes into it, I think, wow, that's who's doing this. I mean, that's who's actually giving a lot of concrete, specific, data-driven thought about what a Christian community will look like here based on who this community is. Yeah.
Would you say that, I mean, in essence, that's a sociological study.
Yeah.
Demographic study.
Mm-hmm.
And often I think those pastor theologians are afraid of those things, when in reality they need to be theologically interpreted. Would you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, more information can't hurt. There's always a mechanistic temptation there to say, like, I don't even need the Holy Spirit to show up. If I just do the ethnography right, we will succeed, right? We obviously ought to know better than that, but also to say, more information, please, more data. Yeah. And then to push that all the way through to a theology. The theology doesn't just happen naturally. You have to be in constant, explicit dialogue with what's in Scripture. Yeah.
Was there another? Yes, over here. Hang on. He's got a mic coming. Thank you.
Sorry. One of the observations I've been making here lately, culturally, is just watching the local news at night and recognizing that these are now the people who are telling us what the morality of the area is. Mm. And for instance, one of the major stories that will come up from the Portland news area is somebody just beat their dog. I mean, that's a huge news story in Portland. And it tells me what the ethics are of the community, and that they are telling us that animals are more important than people. Hmm. So I'm learning that the morality of my area is being defined by the local news.
Hmm. Yeah, that's important. When you talk about doing this theologically, like I said, I think there's theology going on in Steinbeck. You know, I mean, he's explicitly talking about God. Now, he's an atheist, so I don't think he's saying anything really helpful by my lights about God. But yeah, what theology are the local news anchors operating with? You could also have a demonology to get to that, right? You could ask what principalities and powers are driving this sort of hive mind that is articulated by local news anchors. Yeah. local news is hard, you know. That's I watch my local news, and I found it really distasteful when we first moved to California. I turned it on and thought, this is way stupider than news anywhere else, right? And so part of that's just this reaction, like, no, I refuse to be integrated into this culture. This is terrible. And that's healthy, but also part of it is, this is where we live, and this is what color the sky is, and it's beyond my control. So, you know, I need to have some I have some control over how I take it in, but it sort of is the local situation. Yeah.
As I, we'll take a break here, but as I asked, so Fred, if you like to ask the questions, what would be one of the key questions for these pastor theologians to ponder regarding the local context and understanding that through the lens of theology?
Yeah. So I think the key question to ask in the places you're in is, what is the self-understanding of people here? Right? And that's the crucial one. Not to put it too psychologically, but what is their self-understanding? Now, I don't assume their self-understanding is accurate. Mm-hmm. It might be very tellingly inaccurate. But instead of just coming to them and saying, here's who they are, you do, based on scriptural revelation, have privileged insight into who those people are. Like, God has told you something about, you know, oh, well, I know they're in the image of God and they're sinful. So you know that. They may not know that about themselves. And so there's that dance back and forth between, wow, you've got your felt needs and then you've got your real needs, what I'm here to tell you about, but you don't feel them yet. Same thing with self-understanding, but it's crucial, I think, to begin with the self-understanding of a people group. And then you can begin to narrate from within that out towards the connection with the gospel message.
Thank you very much. Let's thank Fred one more time.